I'd like to give a bit of a talk this evening on the four Uttipadas, four usually translated as the basis of psychic power. And in the chanting this evening, we've chanted the basic passage on these four Uttipadas from the Saṅyutta Nikāya. And the four are chanda, which means desire or enthusiasm, and here is essentially the desire to practice, the will to develop the Eightfold Path and realize Nibbana. Virya is energy, citta means awareness, and vimamsa means investigation or inquiry. So these four dhammas are one of the groups that are classified into the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas, and are very sort of well known, well represented as one of the basic groups dealing with practice in Buddhism. However, compared with some of the other groups, like the five Indriyas, for example, five spiritual faculties, or the Eightfold Path, then the four Uttipadas are perhaps a little bit less well known, a little bit less talked about, a little bit more neglected. And one of the unusual things about the four Uttipadas is it starts with desire, chanda. And it's the only one of the major groups and teachings in Buddhism that actually uses the word chanda in this kind of positive sense. The other main place where the word chanda is used is the first of the five hindrances, kama chanda, is sensual desire. So chanda itself is a neutral term. It can be used either in good or bad senses, and this is of course sometimes used as a bit of a point of confusion, and in Buddhism and evangelical Christian paper that we saw a few weeks ago, where they were sort of exposing the so-called contradictions in Buddhism. This was one of the so-called contradictions which they managed to find. And of course the contradiction is no contradiction to anyone who has the slightest knowledge of what the Buddha actually taught about, because what the Buddha said was that in the Second Noble Truth, that kind of desire which is the cause of suffering is described as yayang tanha puna bhavika nandi raga sahagata tatra tatra bhinandini seyatidang kama tanha bhavatanha vibhavatanha. It's that kind of craving which leads to future rebirth and bound up with delight and lust, seeks satisfaction in various states of being. And the three kinds, karma, sensual desire, desire for existence, and desire for annihilation. These three kinds of desire is what's under the Four Noble Truths. So this is the kind of desire to be eradicated. And of course, often in Buddhism it gets mistaken and it gets said that Buddhism wants to get rid of all kinds of desire. And this of course is untrue, and if it were true, it would make elementary, would destroy any possibility of a rational elementary Buddhist psychology, because obviously the Arahant or the Buddha still want to do things. They still want to get up in the morning. They still want to go to the toilet. They still want to eat when they're hungry, and so on. They still obviously have desires, and they wouldn't, if they didn't have desires, they'd just lie in bed in a catatonic state and not be able to move. And that's obviously not how enlightened beings behave. So they have desires, but they only have wholesome desires. They have desires which enable them to accomplish what's wholesome, to realize the Dhamma for themselves and to help benefit others as well. So an arahant will eat, but they won't eat because they have sensual desire for the taste, although even an arahant might perhaps have been challenged by the Lebanese sweets we had for lunch today. But nevertheless, generally speaking, an arahant won't be eating from sensual desire, but they'll only be eating because they want to maintain their body so that they can continue to serve and be a benefit to many people. So they do that out of compassion. And one time, when the Buddha was asked by a Brahmin. He met this Brahmin, and the Brahmin said, "Did you sleep well?" to the Buddha. So I really love this little sutta, and the Buddha said, "Yes, thank you, Brahmin, I indeed did sleep well. Of those who sleep well in the world, I am one. And I lie down out of compassion for all living beings." So this is the Buddha going to sleep. He sleeps out of compassion for all living beings. So again, that shows that difference of the kind of desire. There are some kinds of desire that lead to suffering, lead to pain. Those kinds of desire we get rid of. There are other kinds of desire that lead to happiness, and they only lead to what's good. And so those are the kinds which we cultivate, which are part of the Eightfold Path, which are part of the way that we should be developing our life. And so in Buddhism, we shouldn't find, and again, because this point is misunderstood quite often, not only by Christian evangelists, who can perhaps be forgiven for misunderstanding Buddhism, but less forgivable is the fact that so many Buddhists make the same mistake. And that actually has this quite real psychological effects and social effects and cultural effects that Buddhism often does become very passive. This depends on what kind of Buddhism it is, more so in the Theravada than in the Mahayana, and that practice is seen very much as being an avoidance of doing anything, or an avoidance of wanting anything, even of wanting to do things that are good. And so then you see that tends to lead to laziness, neglect, complacency, and all of those kinds of things. So what we should have is this chanda, which is a kind of like a dhamma chanda, a desire for the dhamma, a thirst, an unquenchable fire and enthusiasm for dhamma practice in whatever form that takes, both helping oneself and helping others. This is what that chanda is as an idipada. So this is something which needs to be cultivated. It's not just something that you either have or you don't have. But when we pay attention to it, we can actually begin to focus on that and realize, well, actually, do I have that? Am I kind of lazy and bored and listless? Do I not have, when I get up in the morning, am I enthusiastic about doing some meditation? Am I enthusiastic about drying my bowl quickly after the meal, and then hurrying back to my kuti so that I can make sure I get in enough meditation for the afternoon? Is there that kind of zing in my step when I leave the Dhamma talk and go back to my kuti or my room? Do I have a sort of zing in my step as I hurry back so I can put into practice the teachings that I've heard? This is the chanda that we have. And the chanda that we have is the fuel or the motivation that lies behind all of the positive action and positive practice that we do. And if anybody wants to develop a good bit of chanda, then they're highly recommended to do what we did today and go and visit the Golden Maximum Security Jail. And I certainly came away from there with a lot more chanda than I had going in. And you know, you go in there and you see that life, and you see, you know, all these guys trapped in a cage, concrete, bare concrete floor and steel bars and very, very little else, walking up and down inside these bars like caged animals. And you see the kind of the incredible suspicion and lack of trust that there is among everybody. And the security systems, the weapons, the guards, everything. And knowing that somebody quoted a statistic, they're saying that 80% of prison inmates in Australia have some kind of mental or psychological problem, and personality disorder or something. So it's an incredibly difficult and stressful environment. And when you're there, you really appreciate what we have here. And I just heard, just as we started the talk, the kookaburras are well aware of this, and they were having a good laugh as they celebrated their good fortune. And we have this incredible good fortune here to have the monastery, to have the land, the trees, the bush, the kookaburras to celebrate our practice and urge us on. And some of the prisoners in the jail, their meditation would be just imagining something like this. they just sit there and imagine being on a quiet beach or sitting under a quiet tree, having a bit of green, a bit of peace around them, and be able to escape to that world, even in their imagination, was an incredible relief for them in their practice, in their lives, which is so difficult. And I really came away from there with incredible respect for those prisoners and for what they're doing, to be able to cope every day in those circumstances, and to just somehow be able to keep going. I don't know whether I could do it. And so much stress and so much difficulty. And of course, that's very much in a very vivid and very immediate sense, is that's the results of bad karma. And that's what happens when you do something wrong, is punishment happens. And it hurts. And we see that in our own lives, in little ways. If we do something wrong or bad, we feel remorse about it, we feel bad about it afterwards. And they're obviously seeing it in a much more dramatic way. And according to the traditional teachings of what happens to you after death, if you do bad karma during this life, then what awaits you in the next life will probably make Golden Jail look like a picnic. And so when you see this and you contemplate, you know, how many people in the world actually have the opportunities that we have here, that to have good food on the table every day, to have clean water to drink, to have clean air, to be able to look at the sky and see the stars, to be able to hear the birds around us, to be able to see the ground, to be able to smell the gum trees, to have good companions in the holy life, to have teachers, to have friends who we can go to in times of need, to have a lay support community who actually give us food and give us the money and other requisites that we need to pay our power bills and our insurance and all of the other costs that it takes to run this monastery. And all of those things are done for us. They're all provided for us. All our educational requirements, the books that we take for granted, the internet access that allows us to do our research, the use of the slide projector for giving the Dhamma talks. All of these things were given solely by the very freely given gift of others. No, there's no constraint there. There's no contract. Nobody had to give us any of these things. And so we have all of these things, our kuti that we go and stay in, maybe simple and humble, but even a simple and humble dwelling, given freely, and how many people in the world don't have even that much as to have a simple, clean dwelling that keeps them reasonably cool in the summer, and, well, I was going to say warm in the winter, but that doesn't quite apply to all of us, I know, but we're working on it, okay, so... In the future, we'll hopefully be able to keep at least reasonably warm in the winter. So all of these things is just an incredible blessing. And we should remind ourselves of this every day. We should remember gratitude to our teachers who have given us this. And, you know, I look back with incredible gratitude on my teachers, with Ajahn Brahman, Ajahn Mahachachai were my main teachers, but then so many others as well, Ajahn Pasano, Ajahn Jayasara, Ajahn Yanadamo, Ajahn Sangaro, and others, Ajahn Akinchino have now disrobed, other lay people that I've learnt Dhamma from, so many teachers, scholars, practitioners that I've learnt from. And not just the teachers, but just people who you can talk to and who have something wise to say, who have a good example to give, and just to remember somebody's gentleness or somebody's kindness, just to remember a simple act of acknowledgement or recognition of kindness or something. This brings a very good feeling, a very lovely feeling, and reminds you of that, how that duty that we have to practice the Dhamma, to really make it worthwhile, to really want to make progress in our meditation, so that if we have obstacles, we really want to overcome them. If we have a lack of energy, we really want to put forth that energy. If we have things that are distracting us from meditation, we really want to be able to get back to our meditation practice. And of course, not just the meditation, but the other aspects of our life here. And all of those we should bring consistently this sense of chanda to when we're doing our chores. We shouldn't think that the chores is something negative or something wrong. The chores are something that is part of our practice as well. The study of the suttas is a part of our practice. The Dhamma discussion, the teachings we have, these are all part of it. Eating the meal, going to the toilet, sweeping up, meeting and talking to people who come to the monastery from time to time. All of these things are part of our practice, and we should engage with all of them with equal enthusiasm. And in that regard of the chanda and enthusiasm for things, I can only say that by the best example I've ever seen is Ajahn Brahm. And he's someone who, after living with him for 3 years, I saw him approach virtually everything with the same enthusiasm, whether it was laying bricks or going to his kuti to meditate or giving Dhamma talks or whatever it was. And he would approach everything with that same sort of infectious enthusiasm. And so it was a delight to be with him and a delight to be able to think that even in a small way that when I was there that I could serve and could help to accomplish those very wholesome and good aims and ideals which Ajahn Brahm had set the monastery up on. And so that again gave rise to a lot of chanda within myself. So that thing of chanda, if we go about our lives listlessly, in the sense of with boredom, with cynicism, with negativity, if we approach our chores and think, the Buddha taught about liberation, not about washing up. If when visitors come to the monastery, we sort of, not more bloody people coming to annoy us. You know, if the time comes for the sutta class, then you're thinking, not more just intellectual theory. The Buddha didn't teach theory. It's all about practice, practice, practice. And if you approach everything in your Dhamma life like that, then when the time comes time for you to sit and meditate, those same kind of moods are going to be carrying on into your meditation. And that will destroy your any chance that you have of a really well-developed practice. And it's an observation, it's not an ideology, but it's an observation that those monks that I know, the senior monks who practice for many years, who approach things with enthusiasm, and who, even though they might do a lot of things, but do them with a good will and a good effort and good enthusiasm, they have good meditation. And those monks who are cynical and negative and who avoid doing things because of negativity, they have bad meditation, even though they might be left alone and be staying by themselves in an ideal conditions. So there's this idea of having the right conditions for meditation, and so they can be staying in a hermitage by themselves, be looked after completely in complete silence and have no demands or stresses and all the right conditions, but they still don't have good meditation. And that's the reason why, of course, is that the external conditions are only part of the story, and that internal condition, and especially that chanda, is not there. And so that chanda is almost like this kind of childlike or sort of quality. It's kind of a bubbly enthusiasm about things, so kind of a wanting. Yes, when something suggests it, yeah, that'd be great, I'd love to do that. And putting oneself forward, and eagerness to try out new things, eagerness to listen to new teachings. When we have different teachers from different traditions come, or when we have an opportunity to travel to another monastery or to a conference or something, to listen to teachings, to be excited and to look forward to that. I think this is a great opportunity to hear, there's a visiting great teacher's coming. Ajahn Dunn's coming, he's teaching a retreat at Wat Buddha Dhamma. And to think, I'd love to go there to be able to hear teachings from a great monk like that. And this again is that chanda, that positive direction in our practice. So as long as we have that, then we won't go too far astray. And then the next quality is quality of virya, or quality of energy, whereas chanda is very closely related to chanda. In fact, in some cases is almost identical, but the difference is that chanda is the wanting to do, and virya is the actual doing. And so virya is the actual performing of the wholesome act, which Chanda wants to do. So Wirya has a very strong aspect of perseverance or persistence. And actually Ajahn Tanisaro, in one of his slightly eccentric translations, I think translates or has translated Wirya as persistence. And even though I think it's probably energy is a better translation, but there's certainly something to that. I sort of recognize that persistence is an important aspect of Wirya, although really persistence is the fourth of the four right efforts. So I won't go into detail in the four right efforts because we already chanted them and discussed them earlier. But the last of the four right efforts, if you remember, is the effort to hold and sustain and develop those good qualities which have already arisen. And in that sense is the persistent element is coming to the foremost. So the aspect of energy, which always to me is always reminds me of, is that the word virya is actually an abstract noun from the word vira, which is a hero, and so virya is literally heroism. It's literally grammatically what it means, and so. It's that quality of a hero. And when I think of that, there's always just a few very specific things which I've heard, and you've probably heard me mention these before, but I'll say them again. But there's one moment in the Lord of the Rings when Frodo and Sam are talking as they're approaching Mordor, and they're talking about who's going to tell their story. And Sam sort of suggests, half in jest, that maybe one day somebody will tell our story. They'll tell the story of nine-fingered Frodo and the Ring of Doom. And they talk about what it is that makes a real hero. And what it makes, in the end, that makes a real hero is that they don't turn back. That all of those who have undertaken the quest, who have set out on the path, but have got some way, and then they've turned around and they've gone back. That's not the real heroes. You know, the hero is simply the one who keeps going, the one who keeps going through life. Again, was thinking about the very poor prisoners in the jail, and just thinking about that, just having to get up every morning and to cope every morning and every day, to be mustered, to be name called, to go in and out, locked in, walk up and down the concrete, and just to keep going, to be able to maintain some kind of spirit, some kind of humanity in that environment. It's really a microcosm, a sort of a very vivid, sort of dramatic representation of life for all of us. And as the song by Bob Dylan, one of my favorite Bob Dylan verses, he said that the friends in his prison ask me what it's like to be free, and he replies to them, "Our bird's free from the chains of the skyways." So it's a very beautiful idea to me, a bird's free from the chains of the skyways. And so, of course, the idea is that everyone has their context, everyone has their limitations. There's no absolute freedom to be found in this world, it's all relative. And very often we live our lives trapped inside our own suffering, and we're trapped inside our own habits, our own defilements, our own ego, our own arrogance, and we can't see a way through that or see the way around that. And we give up too easily. We may be alerted to it, we try to do something for a while, and then we just stop. And we just don't care anymore. And so that's like a lack of wirya, a lack of energy. So that energy, that heroic effort, just keeps going no matter what. It doesn't matter what happens. It doesn't matter if you get sick. It doesn't matter if you can't get anything to eat in the morning. It doesn't matter if you're having to work hard all day. It doesn't matter if you've got a raging migraine headache. It doesn't matter if your leg gets bitten off by a great bear. Whatever happens, you just keep going. Keep practicing. Any situation you're in, any context, any time, there's no time for the Dhamma. It's a beautiful verse that was taught by a bhikkhuni, one of these stories in the, I think in the Ashokavadana, where The bhikkhuni is quite a long story I won't go into, but where this bhikkhuni was criticizing this very old senior monk because he'd never made the effort to practice, and then he said, "Oh, I'm too old. Practice is for young people." And then the teaching essentially is that there's no time for practice. The only time for practice is right here, right now. What is arisen before me right now, that is my practice. That is where the Eightfold Path arises. That is where the Four Noble Truths arise. That is where dependent origination is. That is where anicca dukkha anatta is. That's where the five khandhas are, and that is where liberation occurs. Nowhere else. And so energy just keeps on paying attention like that, and keeps on letting go, keeps on striving with mindfulness, keeps on striving with peacefulness, and doesn't stop no matter what happens. No matter if people are criticizing you, no matter if you're in a bad mood, no matter if whatever happened, you just keep going. And so this is that virya as an idipada. And the third of the idipadas is citta, which is a little bit more subtle and a little bit more ambiguous in the meaning. And you'll find it explained in slightly different ways. The reason for the ambiguity is that the word citta in Pali is used in many different ways, in many different contexts. It, generally speaking, means mind. And so, is interpreted in different, but used in very different ways in different contexts. However, citta, when it's used in the context of the fourth noble truth, that is the truth of the path, is the citta which is to be developed. Citta bhavana, bhavetabha, to be developed. And that citta bhavana does not mean mind in a general sense. Okay, it doesn't mean thought, doesn't mean intention, or any of those kinds of things which citta sometimes means. Citta means specifically samadhi. And citta bhavana is basically a synonym for samadhi bhavana. Citta sampada is a synonym for samadhi sampada, and so on. So here, citta as something to be developed as part of the Fourth Noble Truth essentially means samadhi. So what that means in terms of development and practice is that the essence of samadhi is the quality of unified awareness. And so citta, when we're developing our citta, we're developing that quality of awareness of things, sheer knowing. Okay, so this is similar to the cittanupassana in Satipatthana. Just the knowing of things. And so we stay with that sense of knowing and be aware of things. Now that this is a much more subtle practice than the practices of chandra and virya. And it's also a much more gentle practice. It's not so macho, kind of, you know, I'm going to get there and meditate and do this and that. But citta is very kind of subtle. It just sort of sits back and watches. And so it's what that means is that in every act during the day, we try to be aware with a clear awareness of things. If you're walking, try to be aware of your walking posture with a clear awareness. When you're talking with people, you be aware of what you're saying with that clear awareness. When you're aware of the other person with a clear awareness, you're aware of the things you see. And just trying to pay attention to actually noticing those objects of consciousness. And when you make that as a practice, again, that will carry over into your meditation. And when you come to sit to meditate, you'll be more focused and more emphasizing the quality of just knowing something, rather than the qualities of thinking about them, reflecting, imagining, remembering, and so on. So this is how we develop that citta in everyday life, is just watching things. You can practice that a lot here. You can practice it quite consciously. Just walk through the forest, just look at the trees. And just practice that, just looking, not thinking about the trees. Look at the sky, just look at it. Don't think about it, don't think about anything else, just watch that. And so by developing that receptive aspect of consciousness in that way, this is how we begin to develop the citta as an idipada. When we come into meditation, we'll bring that same quality of just being aware of the breath, or being aware of the metta, or being aware of whatever other meditation object it is that we use. And the last of the idipadas is the vimamsa. It's the inquiry. And vimamsa is just a general word meaning inquiry or investigation, and it's similar to things like the Dhammanupassana in Satipatthana, or the Dhamma Vicaya in the Seven Bhojangas, and so on. But what it has here is quite a specific meaning, as well as inquiry generally, but also is inquiry into the course of the meditation itself, and the causal interrelationship between the different factors of the meditation, and particularly, of course, the other three iddhipadas. So it's inquiry into chanda, inquiry into virya, inquiry into citta, and inquiry into the relationship between those three things. As with all of these, that chanda and that inquiring mind, the vimamsa, the inquiring mind, is fostered and developed by bringing an inquiring attitude into all of our activities. It's by asking questions, by finding things out. If we're sitting in a sutta class, if you really don't understand something, vimamsa is the one that says, but I don't understand it, what's going on? That's developing your vimamsa. If you read something in the suttas, you don't know it, look it up or ask. That's the vimamsa. It's not just content to be ignorant or content to have vague or fuzzy or half knowledge about things. Again, this comes from our sense of Dhamma. If we want to know, we should really want to know what is actually going on, and we should really want to bring our effort and our attention to that. This is that vimamsa, is a sense of inquiry. And inquiry will go right down to the roots of things. It won't rest, it will just keep on going. And so, you know, you can see in my life, I've used that vimamsa for doing the research into different Dhamma topics that I've done. And so that's that quality of not wanting to rest until I can really answer these questions to my own satisfaction, not being satisfied with cheap and simple answers to things, but really wanting to get to the heart of the matter. So again, this is a vimamsa. So there's obviously a progressive quality to these four things, that chanda is the initial thing that gets us going, virya is what sustains us through our practice, citta is the purified state of consciousness which results from the meditation practice, and then vimamsa is like the vipassana side of things, it's the investigation into cause and effect and so on, with relationship to that whole process of meditation. So these are interrelated. You can think of one metaphor that you can use to understand how these things work together is like electricity in a light circuit. If you have the light switched off, then there's a potential in the circuit. Yeah? We measure in terms of volts, that there's a potential across that switch. That potential is the chanda. It's not actually doing anything yet, but it's ready and waiting. It's almost exerting a pressure. It wants to leap across that gap, but it's not ready yet doing it. When we flip the switch, the energy actually flows. And so we speak of electricity flowing through the circuit, just as we feel energy flowing inside ourselves when we're doing meditation. When that happens, the light goes on. Bing! We can see. Yeah, the light is the citta. Yeah, that's what comes when we have energy in our mind, as our mind becomes light, becomes bright. That's the nimitta of samadhi. And then when the light becomes bright, then we can see and investigate and inquire what's there. If we want to know what's in the room, you switch the light on first, and then you can find what's there. You don't hunt around and try to find what's there and not switch the light on. So that's what, like, trying to do vipassana without having a purified mind is like. It's like you've lost something. I've lost my keys. I need to find them. They're in a dark room. And rather than going to all the boring effort of actually switching the light on, I'm going to take the shortcut and hunt or grope around in the room in the pitch black, or maybe just with a little candlelight or something, to try to find my keys rather than switching the light on. So this is why first thing we do is we take the time to switch the light on. And then it's much easier to find the keys. So this is how these things can work together. Now if we look in a little bit more specifically at these four iddhipadas in the sutta, as it's teaching them, chanda samadhi padhana sankhara samanagata iddhipada. And these is like these long compound of words which we should be familiar with and should be able to break up. I think I've explained these before, but just to briefly run over it. And the chanda Padana chanda samadhi padhana sankhara samanagatam idipana. So chanda samadhi, how this is actually explained in the suttas itself. It says dependent on chanda, dependent on enthusiasm, one gains samadhi, one gains one pointedness of mind. Okay, that's the first bit of it. So what that's saying is that the chanda is like a predominant condition, which leads to the development of samadhi, and that's exactly how the four idipadas are taken in the Abhidhamma. The Abhidhamma interprets them in terms of what's called adipati pachaya, which is the predominance condition, like the rulership condition. So in that case, the chanda is like the ruling or the dominating characteristic of the mind that leading towards samadhi. Okay? So that can be interpreted a number of ways, but in one way it might be, say, a personality type. Some people tend to be very enthusiastic, so they really want to throw themselves at meditation and so on. And so that's what leads to good results for them. So that might be a personality character, or it may be just in terms of different tendencies and so on that we have within ourselves at one time or another. and then the other part of the element is the Padana Sankhara in that compound. And here, Sankhara has the meaning of energy, which is quite a common meaning of Sankhara. So Padana Sankhara is essentially just a synonym, as is a very common Pali idiom to sort of emphasize something by banking up synonyms. That's a part of what we were talking about the other day of the sort of backup system in Pali of redundancy. So words and phrases and so on are duplicated, so that if one of them gets forgotten or misremembered, then there's still something there. So that's kind of the sort of information preservation techniques that are used in the Pali literature. So Padana Sankhara essentially just means the energy as well. So what that suggests is that the energy aspect of things is very important for all of the idipadas. The second one, the Virya Samadhi, again dependent on energy, that one gains samadhi and one pointedness of mind. Dependent on chitta or awareness, one gains samadhi or one pointedness of mind. So that refers to the predominance of that practice of just awareness itself as being the primary emphasis in developing samadhi. Of course, all of these things, you know, anyone who wants to develop samadhi has to develop all of them, but one or other may predominate at one time or another, or in one person or another. And then the final one, dependent on vimamsa or inquiry, one develops samadhi. So this is the that case of what's called sometimes the vipassana pubbangama samatha, the vipassana preceding samatha. And so this is where somebody can say in their meditation, the Thai forest masters talk about this sometimes, where you it's sometimes difficult to get the mind to settle down, and so instead you give the mind a lot of work to do, and you actually very actively investigate in terms of, say, impermanence, or watching the body in terms of not self or something like that. And so you're very actively investigating and inquiring, and then you do that until the mind really sort of lets go and gets a revulsion to phenomena or to dhammas, and then really wants to turn within oneself and to develop, to rest within samadhi. So this is like another way of developing samadhi. For most people, when they're developing samadhi, they'll do that kind of practice a relatively small amount. Okay, so you do some of that kind of practice, and that will assist you to be able to let go of the five senses and so on, and to gain samadhi. And in some people's case, they find that they need to do more of that kind of practice. So these are in the actual formal statements of the four idipadas, and for each of them, samadhi is very important. For each of them, energy is very important. And these are the main things that's emphasized in these idipadas. And I should mention as well that the whole purpose of these, or the whole nature of the idipada, is as the basis of idhi, which is, of course, the various kinds of psychic powers. And like most dhamma qualities, it has a sort of ordinary or mundane meaning. Idhi also means like just successful. So like a prosperous, successful country is called Iggy, but most normally used to mean kinds of psychic powers, you know, flying through the air and walking on water and so on. And of course, there's also the Dhamma or the Buddhist interpretation of that is the Arya Iddhi, is the various kind of the noble psychic power, so it can be understood in terms of realizing the noble the practice of realizing the Buddhist, specifically Buddhist truths as well. The reason I think that this particular group was put here and phrased this way is because I think this is a way almost of engaging with the pre-existing ascetic culture in India, which of course very often was not all that interested in liberation, but was much more interested in psychic powers and magical things. And if you look, in fact, even in Buddhist cultures, this is still the case, that very often people are much more interested in various kinds of psychic whiz-bang things than they are in the Dhamma themselves. And so it's a kind of almost a sort of a sort of bit of a trick to get people to say, well, if you want to develop your iddhis, this is how to do it, and oh, meanwhile you'll get enlightened, and then you won't be worried about your iddhis after that. So that's why I think that's used, and that's why I think that energy aspect is very prominent here, because the ascetic culture in ancient India very often attributed the gaining of psychic powers to very kind of energetic practices, especially the tapas, ascetic practice of tormenting oneself and so on, and this generated like a fire of energy. Tapas means fire. And so I think it was like inheriting or adopting this kind of emphasis on heroic striving, is why the energy factor is very prominent here in the Iddhipadas. And it's kind of interesting that it, as well as being very skillful as a teaching in that respect, is also very skillful as a teaching for modern psychology, because the Iddhipadas represent a very positive psychology, as opposed to sometimes in Buddhist psychology is presented in quite a negative sense, in terms of you have to give things up and let things go. And so here we're presented with a way of thinking about Dhamma practice which is very active, very positive, and to have that enthusiasm, that desire, that energy, that inquiry, that brightness of mind. So all these are very kind of positive qualities to emphasize. And actually, if you look at a lot of the things that's been talked about by, oh, I don't know, Tony Robbins and these kinds of people, it's often very similar to the Iddhipadas in developing that kind of positive outlook and framework and so on, and how things get done. So this is very true. You know, if you actually want to accomplish things, then you have to focus primarily on that positive enthusiasm for accomplishing something good, and you can't afford to get too caught up in worrying about and complaining about things that don't work, because then you spend all your time doing that. And it's not to say you ignore them, but they only get you have to make sure that they don't take over. That your main, like 80 or 90% of your orientation is to actually positively do those things that need to be done, and then 10% maybe, or 5% of it is concerned with the problems or the negative side of things. So in terms of practice, as well as the sort of reflective way of practice, you can adopt these different dhammas as like themes for different periods of practice. So you might say, if this group appeals to you, you might say, okay, look, for the next month, I'm going to focus on trying to develop these four Iddhipadas in my daily life. I'm going to choose Chanda for this week, and I'm just going to try and be as enthusiastic about everything as I can. Next week, I'm going to choose energy. I'm going to be as energetic in doing everything as I can. And so you can just choose that for 1 week at a time and sort of try to develop that. But you can also develop it more specifically in your meditation itself. So when you sit down to meditate, you can develop each one in turn. So just repeat to yourself the word chanda, 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 or use whatever English translation you like, enthusiasm, enthusiasm. Or just talk to yourself about enthusiasm. Give yourself a pep talk. Pretend that you're a football coach and that you say, come on, get out there, we've got to do it, you know. You go, you can do it, you're a real Dhamma practitioner. Woo-wee, go out there and do it. And, you know, make a kind of a theatre of it. And so you can do that until you actually really feel the quality arising within yourself, until you actually feel the enthusiasm building up there, and yes, I really want to do this, I really want to sit in meditation for the next half an hour, for the next hour, the next 2 hours, whatever it is. And then the energy, you turn to energy, yes, I feel that energy, and you can actually do it, turn your attention to it and build it up until you actually feel the energy sort of moving through your limbs and through your fingers and through your whole body. You feel this kind of like excitement or thrill of energy coming through your whole body. And then the citta, it's like the awareness of things. If you step back, not being so involved in it, and just watching. It's just a watching mind. Just focus on that. Am I clear about that? Do I know what that watching mind is? Have I got that in me? And then the investigation, the inquiry, looking back at all of those qualities. Now I see those qualities. Can I find them within myself? And am I ready to go for the meditation? So using that vimamsa. So you can develop that for a few, either a short time or a long time. That can be a whole theme of a meditation itself. You can use it while you're doing walking meditation. This walking meditation up and down, and just developing the four iddhipadas like that. Or you can do it just for a few minutes at the start of meditation. And Ajahn Mahachachai recommends doing that, especially for somebody who's developing the third stage in metta meditation, is the stage of equanimity, metta for the neutral person. And so for that neutral person, then your mind tends to drop into boredom and apathy. And so to counter that particular defilement, then bringing up the four iddhipadas at the start of the meditation will then energize the mind and sustain that energy through the whole meditation session. So it's a very, very useful means, especially if you do find that, you know, your mind, say, tends to drop into what they call dropping into bhavanga, the mind just tending to switch off and not paying attention and just going into like a silent or dull state of mind, then you can use the four iddhipadas at the start of the meditation to rouse the mind up and give it more energy, and then it won't drop into those states anymore. So these are some tips and practical ways in developing the four iddhipadas. These are ways that I've used in my practice and I've found to be very useful. And so maybe you can think of your own ways of developing them. Share them with us, or we can have some discussion on that. So anyway, I offer this talk to you for your reflection and for your enthusiastic energy, awareness and inquiry. So does anyone have any questions, inquiries? And if you don't, I know you haven't been developing your vimamsa. And if you can't remember anything about the talk, you haven't been developing your citta. And if you've been sleeping all the time, you haven't been developing your wirya. And if you didn't even bother to show up, then you haven't developed your chanda. A ruini.
Tell us something about that.
Maybe you don't yet.
Can you sort of tell a little bit about, like, you said how you have some of those specific, like, daily tasks? How do you relate with
this point? Well, the enthusiasm about things is a preliminary. It's a necessity, a basic necessity, before even undertaking any practice. Right? You have to have the will and the desire to do it. And so it's foundational for everyone. That's the first thing to be developed. Nibbida, technically, is a very advanced stage of practice, and technically it actually only applies to the stream enterer. So a stream enterer who's already seen the Four Noble Truths then develops Nibbida as a way of turning further and further away from samsara and to realize enlightenment. So that's how it's always invariably presented in the suttas. Okay, so it's often used in a more general sense as being kind of like world weariness, but that's not quite how it's used actually in the suttas. Not really. That's not actually what Nibbida means. No. Yeah, it's used in that way in sort of popular Buddhist discourse, but it's not technically. It doesn't actually mean that. Technically, what it means is that. In like quite an advanced stage of vipassana meditation, and this is defined in brief in the suttas and spoken about in quite a lot of detail in the Visuddhimagga's description of the stages of insight meditation. Then there's like a stage in the development of insight where the world appears to you as just being on fire, as being nothing more than just things falling apart and collapsing everywhere. And so the mind describes this tremendous, like it's a repulsion which turns away from it. And so that's like a force. There's like a stage when actually to sever the sannyojanas, the fetters. So like fetters are actually things that bind us, they bind the mind, and to break those fetters, you actually need that kind of force. But that's a force that comes at a stage of maturity in developing meditation. And particularly it comes after, like abandoning the hindrances, but after developing like a strong degree of like emotional stability and so on. And then when it develops a nibbida. The reason why I'm emphasizing this is because I've seen in quite a few cases where people have really got the wrong end of this stick, and you see people, I've seen people in Dhamma centers who are like almost catatonic in terms of their complete emotional disengagement and it's sort of like a kind of dissociation, and that's actually a psychological condition of being dissociated rather than actually nibbida, and that comes from like lack of compassion, lack of empathy, and so on. It's actually a psychotic state. So it's very, very important that yes, we understand that. We understand that we shouldn't be attached to the world, and so on. And we understand that the path of Dhamma is a path of turning away from those worldly things. But that's done in a very gentle sense, in a very loving sense. Yeah? So that strong sense of nibbida is something that only comes in a very mature practitioner. Yeah? Hopefully, that makes that more clear for you. Developed it a lot, you can do that. You can actually just sit there and you think, I'm just going to do that, and then it just comes up. Just practice. Yeah, just practicing. The more you do it, and the more you make it conscious.
Yeah, I know that.
Oh, if it feels energetic, it is energetic. But I should say that there is probably an ambiguity in the way that the word energy is used. The way that we use the word energy, generally speaking, in English, is probably more similar to the word sankhara in Pali, in the sense of just being a general sort of sense of the energy in things. Whereas sankhara is sometimes used as a term for right effort. But perhaps effort is better, or trying. So it's actually just that it's not actually whether you can be putting right effort even when you're completely exhausted. You know, you're still trying, and that's why that right effort might even be going to sleep, going to sleep is right effort when it's the right time to go to sleep. So it's not actually necessarily that feeling of having lots of energy, although that comes when you try in the right way. Again, like say someone who's physically exercising, that they may be physically tired or physically energetic at one time, and even when you physically exercise, it makes you tired. But if you exercise regularly, then you tend to be more energetic on the whole.
Yeah. So it's more physically, why is there much reason to even take yourself away unless you're absolutely.
Yeah.
But I mean, I find that, you know, if I'm 3 or 4 months meditating for a long time in a good space, I've had a lot of energy in my mind, and I can meditate. Mm. I mean, it's sort of energy like keeps you, it's like a momentum.
Yeah.
In your thoughts. But it's not something that I can just switch on. I mean, if I knew how to switch it on, that would be fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, well, try to do that. If you learn, if you practice that, and especially if you practice like in a retreat time, when you can sort of practice it consistently, and then you learn the skill, and then afterwards you can do it. I mean, obviously it still depends on conditions. You know, if you're like really exhausted or stressed or depressed or something, then you can't do it. But to a certain extent, then you can learn to do it. Yeah.
Just don't get too hard out and measure the road to the power.
Yeah.
The road to power or the way of the power. So all the four factors of the Ittifada are very active factors.
Mm.
They are all the active factors and they are neutral in the term of the morality. They may be right or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on the object we apply the factor to, it becomes wholesome or unwholesome.
Mm.
So they are neutral.
Mm.
In the term of morality, they are neutral.
Mm.
But the object we apply them to achieve, it makes it wholesome or unwholesome.
Mm.
Yeah, so all four factors are very active, and like the chanda, we can interpret it as interest. We feel interest in doing something. If we don't have internet, we can't do anything. And the vision is more, it's just arousing of output for energy to achieve it, to achieve the internet, to persuade your world.
Mm.
And the chitta is here, and I think it's more meaning more determination. Determined to achieve it. And the vimansha is the inquiry factor here it stands for the wisdom.
Yeah.
Yeah. So all the four factors here on the 37 factors of enlightenment, they are wholesome. But all four factors are energy, it manifests in different forms.
Yeah.
And it may be talk in the term of the wholesome, not unwholesome.
Yeah.
Because the goal here is not arousal, not explicitly stop it out, but the goal is for the enlightenment. And the goal is for cut of defilement, to uproot defilement, or to be detachment. So it's not explicitly speak here, but it implicitly it is the wholesome, because the goal is for enlightenment, for liberation, not for anything else.
No, it's a very good point, because you also, you see many times people who do very bad things, they also have a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of energy.
They have all of it, because they apply it for different objects.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I've got a comment on warrior.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a concept of a warrior, sort of warrior heart.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've first encountered that in the spiritual world of Later Nine, at Mahanagora. And it's sort of the attitude of almost a fight to the death against the Kalayas. It's just nearly a relentless effort to not be controlled by the Kalayas. And that is a very helpful mindset to really develop and cultivate, which is what you're a warrior bhikkhu. Just nearly giving up against the Kalayas. So whatever they do to you, whether they try to make you lose energy and effort later,
Even
the intense fear, just the huge courage in certain places to be here. We have all these glazes, I'm not going to get into them.
Okay, so maybe we can finish up our conversation.